This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Today, we are talking about how to make great friends. And we're going to go over a pretty funny article in my mind called Why Men Are Better at Friendship Than Women. But before we go over that, I want to let all their listeners know is next week, that is going to be the 17th of August, we're going to have a recap show. And any listeners who feel like they've got some questions, maybe they've got some comments for Dr. Lyle, maybe you're looking for something to discuss, feel free to call us next week starting at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and we'll be able to take the lines and take the listeners, take the callers, and do what we can to answer your questions. Alternatively, if you don't feel like calling or you can't or the time zone just doesn't work out, feel free to email me at beatyourgenes@gmail.com, and I'll be sure to read your story or your question or your comment on the air, anonymously, of course. But today we're going to be talking about how to make great friends. So, Dr. Lyle, you ready?
I'm ready.
Excellent. Okay. So, before we start, however, there is a question from one of the listeners, and it fits very nicely into this topic of friendships. And so, let's go over it pretty quickly. So, this question is from an anonymous listener, and it has to do with presenting new information to her friends. So, here's the question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I have a question about transformative experiences. Now, your perspective seems to advocate downplaying the potential transformative role of certain information and withholding some of that information so as not to pose a threat and maybe elicit a defensive response. Now, I see this as also going with the picture of human nature as fairly insecure, protective, and defensive, and unlikely to change considerably. What then do you think is the most effective way to get a high rate of return on transformative experiences? And here's an example of that. So the listener writes, I've been a vegan for animals for over 15 years and a vegetarian for another 10 years before that. Originally, the animal rights message was not delivered to me in a graceful or considerate way. In fact, I didn't like the way it was presented at all. And so I didn't want to led on to my friend who presented it to me like that I thought she had made a good point because I didn't like how aggressive she was being. On the other hand, without her and others directly and explicitly telling me this, I would not have had this transformative experience or done the research to understand this topic. Now, I hope I'm more able to present it in a better way, but being direct and getting into the complexities must matter to others. So I don't know if I mind seeing a conflict between grace and directness. What do you think, Dr. Lyle? How do we reconcile these issues, and what can we do to maximize our impact if we want to help people with these transformations?
Yeah, this is a very thoughtful question and very, very wise. This is clearly someone who's lived and has been through, you know, probably more than one sticky situation around such issues. You said it was a woman. Let me try to frame this. The fundamental issue that we're talking about here is going to be esteem. And when we communicate with each other. Those communications can get into problems if the receiver of the information feels like they are not being sufficiently esteemed. And so the problem with the sort of animal rights vegan people, or could be anybody, could be people on other sides of the abortion debate, could be on people other sides of a political spectrum. The nature of the way that people communicate with each other is very often not esteeming people on the other side, essentially being derogatory towards the position that the other person holds. And this is going to elicit people defending their esteem. And so you will see this in the simplest of arguments. You can think about, obviously we can look at it from the standpoint of two warring parties arguing over things viciously, but we can also look at it look at a married couple who's in an argument. And in that argument, the core of that argument is that somebody did not feel esteemed in some way that was important, and they are signaling their irritation. And when the other person receives it, they may feel like that the irritated signal is also a hit on their esteem. And then we spin into what we're going to call a vicious cycle. And this is not good. Now, a few times in your life, you have probably, if you've got any wisdom at all and any sort of ability to inhibit your own worst impulses, you have probably in your life sometime told somebody else that you saw their point or that you could see that they had a point in some sort of an argument. And if you watch that, you'll see immediately the esteem dynamic change, where we gave them some esteem, and then suddenly they are more generous coming back because they're not having to essentially attack and defend their position. I've got theories about why I think this gets so vicious. I believe that these arguments in the Stone Age were observed by others, and most disputes had audiences, and the job of the people in the argument themselves was to be as vicious and quick as possible at getting to the moral high ground and essentially casting the other person as immoral, their argument is defective, and they are in the wrong. And so the notion is that both parties play the same strategy, because it turns out that this is going to be what we believe is probably evolutionarily stable as a strategy. In other words, it's the best strategy over time in evolution, and so that's the one that human beings came up with. Now, I have to say that under an awful lot of conditions, it's not the best strategy. So even though overall it may have been the best strategy for people throughout natural history, that all it had to be was slightly better than alternative strategies, and it winds up being the one selected by evolution. In general, it's a terrible strategy. Okay, so in general, you want to be with your whatever argument that you're making, you want to be sensitive to the people on the other side about what it is that their position is, and to give them some credit, give them some status, some esteem, so that they are not put in a position where they have nothing to lose. And what they have to do is discredit you, because you are nothing but a source of criticism for them. You can sort of see the mathematics of this. If your critic actually gives you a bunch of credit, then you cannot, it is not in your best interest to tee off on them and try to discredit them completely. And so, therefore, it's very wise to give some amount of credit to the other side of an argument or people on the other side of an issue. What I think the gal is talking about here is what I have termed there's a resistance that people have for new information that contradicts the way they've done things before. And there's many potential reasons for this. I believe that there are two that are important. This is what I have actually termed an informational immune system inside of people. I actually coined this term myself, and then it turned out I think somebody else, some cognitive psychologist, maybe had used it also. But the concept is that we are, once we have our position that is defined by ourselves as what we believe is true, and that we have people that are on our side on some issue, and that there may be people on the other side of an issue that, dispute us, we are effectively, we have an immune type reaction to any information that comes in from an opposing camp. And so we don't want to hit that head on. If we're going to try to change someone's mind, it's probably not ideal to hit them head on because you're walking right into their informational immune system. Instead, what we want to do is we want to slip past their defenses. And the way we slip past their defenses is by signaling esteem for them and their position, okay? And actually communicating that we understand and we've thought deeply about their position and we have respect for their reasoning. If we do that, they start to not panic about the fact that they're going to be in an all-out esteem war, and they are now starting to be willing to listen. This is not natural for people to make arguments in this way. This is a very sophisticated way of making arguments, and it doesn't come naturally to human beings to make such arguments. That's because the natural way is everybody's all out, cutting down the opposition, you know, tearing at their credibility if they're criticizing us, et cetera. But it is absolutely the most effective way to do things, even though it takes more cognitive energy and it takes restraint and it takes a lack of rush that we think that the village is all going to be watching and making a quick decision on this in the next 60 seconds, which is how everybody behaves when they're in arguments. So instead, what we want to do is take your time, essentially find strong points in the other guy's argument, feed those back to those people with respect for their reasoning and for their position, and then we introduce a question that we have, not a statement or a conclusion, but a question we have about where it is that they're coming from, because we are aware of some possible different way of looking at it. And as we introduce it that way, they are not nearly as defensive, and we are able to get the possibility of some change. So that's how I look at the problem, and it's a tough one. It's a tough one with big emotional issues where there are battle lines between good and evil in people's minds, and it's important that we find a way to make this shades of gray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always thought that transformative experiences from information, I mean, it's really just hard to create that in somebody else. It's almost like they've got to go through that journey all on their own with a couple of guiding posts. But yeah, it seems like it's a difficult thing to do.
Well, transformative information is by definition, I mean, it's sort of a fancy word, but what it really is it's if you have an important question for you, if there are somewhere in your life where there's significant chips on the line, for some reason, and you have been doing things one way, but you have not been actually seeing the whole picture. And so as a result, you get some new information that opens your eyes, and that you now believe in a new vision that where it has significant, you know, has significant consequences for you, or so you believe. It might be from your diet, or might be from your religion, or might be from your politics. Who knows what this might be? And so as a result, as is typical for people, they're going to try to share this information with the world, with their village anyway, within sight of anybody's hearing, because they believe that it's so important, because it was so important for them, and that they want to get credit for bringing the new information to the village. And so then if they get stopped because they run into some immune defense, informational immune defenses, then they can get very frustrated, and then they can get aggressive. And at that point, then you're just going to hyperactivate everybody's immune defense, and you're going to wind up with a mess. I've seen that happen to more animal rights activists and vegan vegetarians and everything under the sun that essentially push too hard trying to share their transformative experiences with their families and their friends and acquaintances, and they wind up with a mess. And sometimes those messes have tremendous consequences in families and with friendships, et cetera, and they were unnecessary. And so using the tactics that this woman has essentially described about being more patient and finding ways to find a much muddier moral middle ground on all of these things, and to express some humility from your own position. Like, you know, these are interesting ideas that I have. Not sure I'm right about everything, but I think it's these are things that I'm now finding I think are worth thinking about. If we use that kind of a position, we're much less likely to essentially get everybody amped up and defensive.
Yeah, you don't have the Buddhist monks running around getting into these aggressive battles about Buddhism.
Well, you might, but we don't see it, and they're not supposed to. Yeah.
All right, so let's get on to this article. It's a pretty funny article. Obviously, it's satire, but it says,
sure.
11 reasons why men are better at friendship than women. So
I can't wait.
It's from Men's XP Magazine, which is probably the equivalent of, like, you know, Cosmopolitan or something like that. So,
Okay.
Oh, and it's written by a woman. So here we go.
All right.
Reason number one. Men can really have a friend's back. Like, truly, really. If a man calls someone his friend, his buddy, his pal, he's usually there for him for life. Men value friendship and live by the fact that a friend in need is a friend indeed. Always trust a man to save his friend's ass in times of need.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what this cute little gal is thinking. Like, she clearly didn't know anything. The the truth of the matter is that yeah, we got to give her some esteem. Actually, since she'll never hear us, you know, we can go ahead and trash her, and we just talk straight to our audience. Males and females don't differ in how good of friends they are. Individuals differ in how good of friends they are. And so, if it were true that males were better friends in evolution than females, then there would be an incredibly important evolutionary selection pressure for this being true. So there would have been some reason for females to be more flighty and backstabbing and defecting than males are. And I don't see what that reason could possibly be. So you might say, well, females might be willing to backstab their friends because their friends are sexual competitors. Well, males are also sexual competitors and are known to mac on each other's wives and girlfriends. So there's no reason to think that there is any fundamental difference between males and females. There is absolutely individual differences in people. And so the agreeableness and conscientiousness and emotional stability of humans differs dramatically. And so the quality of an individual as a friendship for you, and not only that, it's also true that individual circumstances change and the cost-benefit that people run on other individuals as friends is always changing. And so the truth is that people's decisions about how to treat their friends is always being seen through a cost-benefit analysis. And then, of course, the more disagreeable people are running a much, much finer-grained, sharper pencil point cost-benefit analysis and are therefore less trustworthy, and they are, you know, essentially not as good of friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how about if we've got – I was talking about this with a friend who I think is just about as disagreeable as I am, and we were discussing these personality characteristics, and we were thinking, like,
yeah,
in romantic relationships, it probably – might make sense that someone's going to be more agreeable and the other person's going to be more disagreeable because they'll be willing to put up with each other that way, or at least the disagreeable person is going to have the way benefit of this. Whereas with friends,
yeah,
if one person's agreeable or disagreeable, they might, you know, the disagreeable person might get more, but they're not going to be able to relate,
right,
to each other when they complain about life, as friends often do.
Yeah, it's interesting. However, this is where the ecological context of a friendship gets to be interesting. Because if two disagreeable people are friends, they better not be in business together. In other
yep.
words, they better not have direct conflicts of interest with each other, or there's going to be a big problem. Okay, so in general, the agreeable people are like, you know, carbon atoms. They can attach to anything, and everything works. And that's you know, so you will find agreeable people will be friends with disagreeable people, they will tend to get exploited in those relationships. That's sort of a risk that you have as an agreeable person, is that you're likely to get exploited. You're also likely to never be left out in the cold, whereas disagreeable people are the ones scratching their head on Christmas Eve trying to figure out how come, you know, they're not anybody's house by a fire, okay? So, because, you know, what happened? No friend, no mate, no family. It's like, well, what happened was is that you ran too hard a bargain on everybody and you wound up with nothing. So, you know, that is the story of Ebenezer Scrooge doing exactly that. So, yes. So this is the nature of the quality of friendships is within the personalities of the individuals within it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're both about the same level of conscientiousness, so we can understand our own frustrations when people are more flaky towards us, and it totally makes sense when we can see something.
Yeah, if you got a couple of disagreeable people and their friends, they better at least have some conscientiousness and mm-hmm. some intelligence, because that can override some of the otherwise absurd self-serving judgments that they would otherwise be making about life.
You're reminding me of an acquaintance that I had who was not as conscientious. Okay.
Yes.
So right. Number two, men follow the bro code like it's a Bible. While women too have certain do's and don'ts in friendship, nothing beats the sanctity of the bro code that men abide by. And the bro code that lays down certain unsaid norms and friendships is something that every guy, even unknowingly, follows to the hilt. Be it not getting involved with a friend's ex or saving his ass at his hour of need, every guy respects the bro code at all times.
Yeah, this is all pipe dream. Like, what did she read? The King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table? And, of course, if she did, she forgot that Lancelot was having sex with Guinevere, for God's sakes. Okay, so the this woman is smoking some weed. She's gone to, you know, I don't know, a Rocky movie or something, or I don't know where she learned what she thinks is true about men. But no, there is no bro code, and I'm in my late 50s now, and I don't know of such a thing. There are men and there are women that if they are very good friends, if you have an exceptionally good friend, of which, you know, I have one extraordinarily good friend, and that extraordinarily good friend would is actually a female, and she would risk her life to save me. I don't know if there's anybody else in my life that would. I've got a couple of, you know, good male friends who, you know, they might risk a little equity in their house. Okay, not much. Maybe a good size check. I don't know if we'd get all the way to six figures, but the best friend that I have would risk her life, and I feel similarly towards her. So this is more about individuals and their own personal connections and their personalities than it is about anything else.
Mm-hmm. I have a listener who's commenting right now. It says, any bro code can be broken if the girl is hot enough.
Give that listener a big thumbs up. Thank you. Absolutely.
That
sort of drifts through my mind whenever I see a friend that has a hot girlfriend. It's like mm-hmm. it instantly starts to compute, you know, what my suddenly there's creative ways of imagining your friend's death. All right, let's go
right.
on.
Next on. Men, they give each other space. Now, women may argue that men don't share their innermost feelings with each other as openly as women do, which is true. Fact is, men let each other be. They don't step on each other's toes with a constant need to share everything, which is why whenever a guy wants to chill, he chooses his male buddies. No pressure, just plain acceptance.
Well, I'll tell you what. There's going to be some differences between men and women. And, this is sort of this little superficial, surface-level description that that would pass muster for a nice little cheap throwaway magazine article. But the gal has identified a pattern that has some legitimacy, and that is that male and female relationships, good relationships, will have a significant difference in some of the content of what's going on inside those relationships. And one of the important content that goes on in relationships is that women are almost always in some kind of hot water with respect to relationships. So with respect to their romantic relationships. In other words, an awful lot of times, women, let's suppose some woman is dating some guy and they've been together for 3 years and she's sweating what I call the big pickle. And the big pickle is I'm getting into my 30s.
Is this big pickle okay for radio, Dr. Lyle?
So this is okay for radio. Yes.
Okay. Making sure.
So the big pickle is the female is in a tough situation, and she's trying to read the tea leaves of her mate's psychology, trying to figure out what his motivation is and whether or not she's being strung along for a long-term casual mating ride, or whether or not this is a commitment pair bond situation. And so women are routinely in these circumstances. And if they're not in those circumstances over a longer-term relationship, they're in those circumstances over a short-term relationship. And if they're not in those, then they're in a situation with their marriages, and there's significant problems with their marriages. And they're trying to figure out, should I go, should I stay, you know, how upset should I be about the situation the way it is? And so as a result, they process a lot of these decisions with their good friends. And the reason why they're doing this and males aren't doing it is because very often the male doesn't have anything to lose in this decision-making. He's ambivalent. He might be ambivalent about whether or not he wants to stay or leave in a relationship, but he doesn't need to talk it over with his buddy. He's just going to follow his instincts. And he's going to maybe string a woman along for another year. And so he doesn't have to think about this. He's not the one under pressure of a time clock, the one with the tremendously expensive sexual treasury that is being harvested by his girlfriend. That's not what's happening. The shoe is absolutely on the other foot. Female sexuality is vastly more valuable than male sexuality. And as a result, if a female is giving that up in a relationship, she needs to be doing a very strict accounting as to whether or not this payoff is the right one for her. And so as a result, she needs to process this with her friends, because she's trying to get a bunch of brains on the problem to try to make sure that she's not screwing this thing up. And so women will talk endlessly and analyze every little move of the male. And he said this, and then he did that, and then I was ready to dump him, but then he bought me this, and then he said he was real sweet, and then he said he talked about our future, and blah, 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 okay? So then she's back in the big pickle. So the males don't have the big pickle particularly, and they don't particularly need their friends' feedback about these decisions. And so therefore, obviously, male and female conversations are quite a bit different. Males are going to be talking about sports and how the Giants are doing and Madison Bumgarner's arm and all that. And that's just fine. The check-in on their relationships is 15 seconds, whereas women, nothing is more important to them than analyzing these things. So chick relationships have a lot more psychological mindedness and analytic quality to them. And that isn't – nobody wants space. Everybody's interested. And that's part of the chick world, is to be there doing that.
Now, is it a red flag if a girl has friends who are not very intelligent about this? Because they'll kind of encourage wrong thinking?
A red flag, I mean, if you're a guy?
Yeah. Like if you're looking for a pair bond situation, if you're looking for a pair bond situation and you're dating a girl and her friends just, you know, aren't really aware of the right way to look at these things. So they're constantly giving the wrong information about where the intentions are coming from and all that. Is there instinct kind of right? Or is this an intelligence issue?
Oh, it's an interesting thing. people can be pretty naive and not very smart about this, and let me tell you why. The reason is that these are evolutionary games, and as a result, this is the girls against the boys, and so as a result, it's going to turn out that the girls aren't that smart about this, and the boys aren't that smart about it, and then it gets worse because it turns out your friend, if you're a female, your friend may have absolutely have conflicting agendas. So if it turns out that you're dating some hot guy and you're pretty happy about it, but you got some insecurities about it, your friend might just assume that you don't look like you won the village gene game, and she'd just soon encourage you to break up if you're feeling some anxiety or you have moments of insecurity. So now this depends upon how good a friend this is. And that friend is now running a cost-benefit analysis on, how bad it looks for her that you got the hot guy, as opposed to, how valuable the friendship is to her, okay? And so this is where things get very complicated in human affairs. And so the if you this is why it's a good idea that, when people enter relationships, that they just sort of, in some ways, take your birth control or practice your birth control, and otherwise go ahead and try to just push everybody else out of the pool, and we don't need their input, okay? So we don't need the input of your family, we don't need the input of your sister, we don't need the input of your best friends, we don't need anything, okay? What two people need is just sort of time to get to know each other and take your sweet time and let the evidence come to you in a nice natural way. And if people are sexually active, then for goodness sakes, protect yourself so that we don't wind up with a moral crisis on our hands. And remember that if you are in a bad situation as a female and you are not very happy a couple three, four, five, 6 months in, but you're having a trouble breaking up, remember that you are probably designed by nature to believe that you may be carrying his little incipient child, and therefore you're designed to stick with him even though it's lousy. And this is where you have to beat your genes. If your relationship is lousy, but you're feeling like you're too anxious to leave this guy, but you're not that happy, you must beat the genes and get out. You have to literally chew yourself through the chains. If you miss a tooth, fine. You'll grow another one, okay? You get out if you're not happy, and do not let your genes order you around in these kinds of situations. But yeah, as far as your question is, we don't need a lot of third-party information. What you mostly need is you mostly need quiet one-on-one time with your partner, and you will let the evidence tell you just how happy you are as time passes.
All right, number four.
So hold on. I want to
Men.
add something.
Oh,
Hold
yeah.
on. I want to add something to this. The reason why people will a lot of times not honor their instincts won't honor the advice that I'm talking about is because the women are anxious because they are expending their sexual treasury chips, and they inherently feel vulnerable about it, and they are designed by nature to try to bail on this relationship as fast as they can if it turns out it's not a good pair bond solid sort of a thing. So they actually are operating on a knife's edge, okay? And so this is where friends and friends' feedback is a lot of times not that useful, because even if a good friend is still operating with conflicting agendas, and everybody's too far in the blind, okay? So the right move is to do what I say, which is to, if a relationship has promise, give it some rope, give it some time, but when it's not good, when it is not good, okay? And if it is not good, it's usually not good in 3, 4 months, and you can smell it. There are problems. And down in your soul, you know what? This isn't that good. When it's not that good, you get out. Okay, that is where we need to beat the genes.
Very interesting. Yeah, and so instead of talking to third parties, basically they should just call into the show, is what we're saying.
Yes, call into the show. I will tell you what to do. Yeah,
Yeah.
I have no problem. I have no problem telling people that the following is true. If you've got some conflicted relationship that's 4, 5, 6 months or a year in, and you can't seem to leave, you're not that happy, and there's problems, and you're going back and forth, you don't need to run to your friends. What you need to do is you need to get a break, okay? You get yourself a break, and you give yourself about a two-month break. You just sort of chill out. If this relationship is so fantastic, and this relationship has such promise, and this relationship, you know, this is the best relationship of your life, et cetera, then that is not going to change in 8 weeks. Okay? That is not going to change. It is exceedingly unlikely that they would find a superior replacement for you in 8 weeks. And it is not a process where we have to put one little brick ahead of the time and that if it ever comes apart, then we lose the tapestry. Absolutely no way is this true. Michael Jordan steps away from basketball for 2 years, and he comes back, and he is still phenomenal. People that have the dynamic chemistry between them, if they have the chops to really love each other, and it could be a great relationship, if you take time apart for a couple months, you come back together, no way that doesn't refire, okay? So that's like a chemical rocket. There's no way when you mix those chemicals, they don't come together. Now, more likely what happens is the woman gets herself away, convinces the Stone Age brain that she's not pregnant because a couple months goes by and there is no pregnancy. She hasn't been sexual with the guy for a couple of months. She is relieved to actually be out from under that sword over her head of the tremendous indecision of of what's been happening in the relationship, how uncomfortable she is. And now it turns out there's no way she's interested in going back. Okay. That's most likely what's going to happen if the people will give themselves a chance to get out from under the ether.
Yeah, they may even be able to shorten that time if they leave right before their menstrual cycle begins.
Yes, okay. Well, I haven't charted it out that carefully, but on we go.
All right.
Good.
I'm all about efficiency, Dr. Lyle. You know me.
Yeah, I see that. I see that. You got a sharp pencil point.
All right. Number four, men have realistic expectations. Although guys usually stand up for their bros, they don't berate them when they are not able to. We hate to admit it, but guys are much more chilled out than women. Women tend to have a love-hate equation in friendships. They can go all out to pamper their friends, but they also expect the same in return. Men don't.
Yeah, fundamentally, there are some differences in men and women that are pretty significant. And one of those differences is that women are fundamentally, they're kinder. So women are more agreeable inherently than men are. And so men also, interestingly enough, are significantly more uncomfortable with conflict in the sense that conflict can cause men to essentially fire up some violent feelings. And so as a result, they're uncomfortable. They don't like it. And they particularly don't like conflict with women because there's a low grade feeling that they don't want to be in a position where they're actually going to have aggressive impulses. So this was very interesting research that was done by John Gottman. I think he was at the University of Washington when he did this. This was probably 40 years ago. It was very, very interesting research. And it showed that in conflicts in relationships, men absolutely wanted to get out of the room. And they wanted to just get space because as the things were getting contentious, they were getting their adrenaline was rising and they were getting upset. Interestingly enough, in Gottman's research, when they studied couples in conflict, they found that this was true. It was an astounding, as I recall, we're going back 40 years now, but as I recall, the score was that it was like 36 times out of 36 times. In every single case of conflict, the male wanted more physical space, and he wanted to be out of there. And it was never the case that the female wanted space. So this was an extraordinary finding, and then I believe later research found that a big issue was this sort of adrenaline, aggressive sort of impulses that were riding through the males' minds under conflict. So it is likely the case women are much, much happier with conflict, in the sense that they're not being disagreeable, but it's just not upsetting them quite as much. And so they can probably talk and fuss and disagree and so on and so forth, in some ways, that it isn't as momentous, to some degree, possibly. And so it certainly is the case when men and women themselves have conflict between them in a couple situation. So anyway, I'm sort of spinning out here, out away from some hard data, but I think I can't even remember where I started, quite frankly, Nate. I'm lost.
Men have realistic expectations, whereas women constantly expect more from their friends. So they tend to have a love-hate equation, whereas men
I
don't,
mean, I don't think there's
apparently.
no, I don't think there's any truth in that, but I think that realistic expectations, no. Now, we're just going to reject the whole thing and go on to the next comment.
Sounds good to me. I didn't really understand it either.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. Number five, men forgive and forget more easily than women. Men rarely hold a grudge against their friends for little things, like not turning up for a birthday party or forgetting their birthday even. Unlike women, men give little importance to these little breaches in commitment. They don't read too much into their friends' actions and usually give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, I'll just say I had lunch with a business friend of mine a couple weeks ago, and we were just talking, and he had some drama in his office where the women of the office were creating drama. And he said, you know, it's really, really interesting when men have conflict. He was telling me, he goes, they just go duke it out in the parking lot and they come back friends. Whereas women, they want to ruin each other. Like they want to ruin each other's lives. They keep this held in for the rest of their life.
That's very interesting. I actually don't know. Let's see. We started about, say again what the comment was that women that
Men,
they don't forget the slights.
yeah, men
That they
forgive and
don't forget
forget
the
more
slights.
easily.
You know, I don't know. I think that's a I can't I obviously the several features of personality is involved here. So obviously there's an awful lot of very easygoing women out there that never packed a grudge about anything, and there's unbelievable males out there that are such grudge packers that they can't even function. So the question is whether or not there's what we call a main effect, whether that there is a that there's a general direction of truth for this observation. And that's an interesting scientific question, and I'm trying to think about what it is that I actually believe. It certainly seems that women, I think part of what people may be discussing there and what's caught their attention is that women are paying a lot of attention to the state of what I'm going to call their coalition. And so they're trying to figure out who's in the group and who isn't in the group, and they can be intensively social and having all kinds of little processes that are all about testing group cohesion as to who's in the group and who's not in the group. Men are inherently, to some degree, more independent of group cohesion processes, so they're not tracking it probably quite as closely in a lot of ways. Let me explain a little bit why males and females are going to be somewhat different on this domain in terms of how carefully they're watching processes. And it's a little different than my conclusion would be a little bit different than this author's inferences here. The women, men and women essentially coexist and coexisted and evolved in Stone Age groups, probably call it about 30 to 50, maybe 60 people, a third of which were children. And so as a result, it's going to turn out that there was the grand conflict in those groups is going to be male casual mating strategy. So the fact that the males are going to be wanting to have sex with more than one partner, and that they're going to be competing with each other very vigorously, even physically and aggressively, for the most attractive sexual partners, these things cause potentials for the group to literally break up. So the group can no longer function. Women are going to be designed by nature to want to keep group cohesion. So they are actually doing a lot of little social work naturally to keep people together, to keep them connected, to keep them involved, and to be smoothing over all kinds of ego bruises that are taking place throughout this process as men and women advertise to each other, and the men compete vigorously. The women are competing with each other as well, and they're forced into competition. Women are friendly enough in general. They wouldn't necessarily want to compete with each other, but they have to. They don't have a choice. So it's women working at the village cohesion process that is deft and subtle, okay? Not that they aren't competing, but they're also working pretty hard to keep cohesion. And they are noticing when people are breaking ranks, and they have, you know, a more conflicted agenda than the males. The males in general recognize that we're competing with each other. And if we get threatened from the outside by other males, we will band together instantaneously, as we will defend the village with our lives against people from some other village, some other men that are warring on our people. But other than that, men are going to give each other plenty of space because they are inherently more competitive with females, and they're perfectly comfortable with that sort of relaxed, low-grade competition and distance. So the females are much more a little intensive. They're trying to, like, weave the village together. The men are willing to have the village have conflict and maybe even break apart. And so in those differences, I think you will see some of the social dynamics that these people are observing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that leads us right into the next.
I.e., the women are sweating the small stuff. They are looking carefully to take the temperature of the village cohesive dynamics, and the men are not as concerned about the small dynamics, because if all hell breaks loose, it's not that bad as far as they're concerned. And so they are more willing to walk and let the whole damn thing break apart if it needs to, in order to serve their personal, their personal sexual career. If it all goes to hell, it all goes to hell. We'll live with it. Whereas the females, that's a bad, bad thing for them. They would like, despite the sexual competition that is driving turbulence in the village, they want to keep that village together as big as possible, because that helps defend them and their children against marauders from the outside.
Yeah, that leads directly nicely into the next part of this satire article, which is that men don't bitch behind each other's backs. Men may hate other men, but one thing they don't do is betray the trust of their friends by bitching behind their backs. They don't like somebody, they are not friends with them. Of course, there are exceptions, and men would have at some point of their lives done that, but they're not given into backbiting in friendship as a habit. Now, I don't know. I've had a fair amount of, you know, ex-friends that did that, but that happened to me, male.
Well,
so.
I've talked behind people's backs consistently. So I would say, though, that again, I think that the observer of this may be seeing exactly what I just described. That the women in general are taking much closer temperature at relatively small details of group cohesion dynamics. They're more upset when they see a move on the part of the female that could be risky to the entire cohesion of a group dynamics, and they're, i.e., somebody macking on somebody else's man, and that, you know, that may get everybody all upset. It could be as simple as somebody loses 10 pounds, starts looking better, and shortens up her skirt. It's like, oh boy, we can't have that. Okay, now you're threatening hair bonds all over the village. Okay, so the guys are more comfortable and are more okay, and are not going to try to backbite in the same way. One thing that I have definitely seen in male and female group dynamics. And again, I don't have data for this. This has been my personal observation, that if a great looking, handsome, cool dude strides into a new village, like, hey, you know, you just kind of realize there's not a damn thing you can do about it, and you just live with it. And you can hear all the twittering of all the females through the village, and you just realize that your odds with everybody just went down a big chunk, okay? Whereas if a hot woman enters the village, all hell breaks loose. There's very often some concerted efforts on the part of females to try to trash her reputation, talk behind her back, and drag down her mating status as fast and as viciously as possible. And so this is because that female, is a pretty brutal threat to pair bonds, in a way that the hot guy that comes in probably isn't going to threaten your pair bond if you're a guy. That's probably not going to happen, but a hot female can threaten anybody's pair bond, and a hot female on the loose. And so I think essentially the value of pair bonds and the likelihood of males stepping out versus females stepping out behind opportunity, those differences, those natural sexual differences, give rise to an awful lot of cattiness in females that you do not see in males.
Which leads right next to another point, which is that men, they confront each other, even if it means a fist fight. And while they're often accused of piling things on and not sharing their emotions, the ironic fact is that when it comes to friendship, the opposite often happens. While girls will secretly mind the fact that her friend was rude to her one day, whereas guys will make their feelings apparent and then they don't make a big deal out of it.
You know, could be true. And again, we're going to talk about, and for listeners that are you know, subtle and scientific and very smart, they would instantly see exceptions all over the place. And that's not, you know, I completely understand that. But what we're talking about here is, in statistics, what we call main effects. Is there truth in this at all? In other words, is there a tendency for this to be the case? And I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. I don't actually know the evidence on that and whether anybody's looked at it. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was a tendency for women to be more inhibited about and paying attention to these little small slights, maybe remembering them more, et cetera. Not sure, interesting, and I'm not sure they're observing anything real there, but they might be.
Would you agree that this next point that the author wrote is that men are less judgmental than women?
No, I don't think that that's likely to be true. I think it's likely to be, I think that what she's noticing is, and what you can take notice of is in specific domains. So women are going to be very judgmental about other women with respect to other women, attractive other women, or reasonably attractive other women, signaling their availability as casual mating strategy partners. That women are unbelievably upset about. Okay, men are not, because men know that competitive men are signaling their availability as casual mating partners all over the map. That's what guys do, and we just live with it. Okay, so I think again, this is getting down to the cattiness and getting down to the quote judgmentalness. I think in general, women aren't more judgmental about somebody's political beliefs or religious beliefs than men are. I don't think so at all. But I believe that what she's describing here is something more close to home and much more personal and important to people, which is women are going to be very judgmental, specifically about competitive women. And those competitive women's breasts, excuse me, that was a Freudian slip. I meant to say dress, and I said breasts. All right. So
we know about Freud, remember?
I He's a big man in the neighborhood. Everybody loved him. Very well respected. God rest his soul.
Oh, he passed away?
Yeah. No, I just like saying God rest his soul. Of course he passed away. I was about 12 at the time.
We all know about Freud.
Yeah. So, yes, women are going to be pretty ruthless about judging other women that are competitively attractive and their style of competition. Any sign that those females are at all sucking up to local alphas or are signaling the possibility of casual mating strategy in their behavior, and look out, the cat fight is on. Whereas if a good-looking woman enters an arena and has Parabon all over her, in other words, her dress is at her knees, nothing is tight, you know, nothing fancy about her hair, it's not frosted, you know, nice solid diamond ring on her finger, and what's on her inner cubicle is pictures of her three children and her nice solid Parabon-looking husband, then nobody's going to be upset, okay? But as soon as it looks different than that, that same woman dressed differently, acting differently, no ring on her finger, and is flirting with the local alpha or would-be alphas, look out. Look out for the, quote, judgmentalness to be all over that office.
Very interesting. Now, we have a listener here who just decided to call. And let's see who this is. Put you on. Okay, hey, caller, how you doing? This is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Lyle. How are you?
Hi there. Good.
What's your name?
I can appreciate, I do have to agree with you, Dr. Lyle. I think that if you want to compare men to women, that I feel like two guys will kind of duke it out if it lands in a fist fight, and then the next day it's kind of forgiven and forgotten. Whereas I do think that women will kind of go out of their way to ruin your life after the fist fight. You know, they'll create stories or do whatever, try to wreck your reputation, you know, ruin relationships. And I think that there's definitely daggers. But I think that because guys are inherently competitive and they have some of those same characteristics, that similar things are done over like a broader period of time. It's almost, in my opinion, like in life, they'll set out to be better or compare themselves. I think that they just make broader generalizations as far as what kind of guys they think that girls like or what they think that girls want and what they can offer that others can't. It's in everything that they do, where with women it's like specific to the incident. I think that women go about their lives trying to be better than the next girl, whereas guys just have that kind of competitive nature, as you had said earlier.
Yeah, I think I hear where you're coming from, and I think there's some truth in what you're saying. I would say that I believe one reason that women go underground and get catty is because they're going after one particular issue. They go after the issue of whether the woman is the competitive woman is being loose and essentially cheating at the game of getting a Parabon partner, or rattling high fancy DNA of the males loose. And the women will be ruthless about going at each other in this way, because if they can convince the village that an attractive competitive woman is in fact loose and is unscrupulous in her sexual behavior, the women can form an effective coalition to get that woman kicked out of the village. Okay, and it's a dangerous tactic, because as you and that's why you have to be careful, why these women plot very carefully about how they do things. This is not like a guy's sort of thing. The equivalent would be a major military coup on the part of a beta, you know, a male trying to overthrow alpha. He would be quiet and ruthless about it, and he might pull it off. Probably not. But women's
ability.
I feel
like you can see examples of that in society. If you want to look at like media or corporations that are predominantly like male run, like sometimes does the lie become the truth? You know, maybe they're just better at the game of chess, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, I think if we look back in evolutionary time, the fundamental place where women get tough in ways that men aren't is in undermining sexual reputations, okay? And that men don't do to each other. That won't fly, but it will absolutely fly with females. It is a useful and ruthless tactic. It's a dangerous one because if you try to paint an attractive woman as potentially loose, she potentially gets more interesting to a lot of males, including your own. But at the same time, you also essentially can trash her reputation as essentially not worthy of being a pair bonder. And if you can do that, you can essentially paint her as someone who's so problematic that we can't have her in the village. And you can make her life so miserable that she leaves. And you know what? That happens, and that is not something that males do. So, you know, I think you've got some points there.
Yeah, I always
assumed.
I always assumed that with men will duke it out in the way men duke it out in the way that they have to display what they're valued for, which is their size and their strength and their ability to provide. So they're going to outprovide. They're going to try to outprovide each other, which is what you were talking about. They're going to try to get better than the next guy, and they're going to try to show off their size and strength, which is fighting. Whereas women, they don't have size and strength to fight it out with. So what are they going to use? They're going to use their social abilities and their intelligence.
Yeah,
their fingernails and their ability to pull long hair.
Yeah, a little bit of that. But yeah, the most ruthless thing they have is the quiet seeding in the village that the other woman does not have sexual fidelity, and that casts a pall over that woman's pair bond value. And so this is where women get ruthless in a way that men don't.
You know, I was a bartender for 11 years, and the thing that always interests me when you're the only sober eyes at 2 o'clock in the morning is women are definitely way slicker at shady ways. So, like, I've seen a girl give her number when she's on the right side of the guy and his girlfriend is on the left, you know, and she underslips that phone number with the, you know, the call me versus some guy just made out with a girl and his girlfriend walks in 5 minutes later and he has this tendency to like trip over himself and almost get himself in trouble and expose himself, you know, for having done something wrong. Girls definitely like get right into the mental game.
Yes. And I think that for a long time, evolutionary psychology, probably in the 1990s, was a little bit devoid of a lot of understanding of the subtlety of the female competitive mind. And that was because in the early goings, the basic tenets of evolutionary psychology are quite comfortable to males because we're not afraid about talking about casual mating strategy and we're not afraid about talking about beauty. And so these things were very upsetting for females and it kept a lot of female minds out of the field. But since that time here in the last 15 years or so, a lot more, you know, academic women, not a lot, you know, because the whole field is dangerous. The whole field is a place to get rejected by academia. But more women have come in to the field of evolutionary psychology and have helped us shed insight onto exactly the kind of things that you're talking about, which is the deftness, the subtleness, and some of the schemes that women run, which are not typically consistent with male psychology. They run, they can be very competitive, but they do it in different ways.
I also think in the last number of years, there's been a bit more of a social acceptance of women kind of, how do I want to say this? Like guys could always be as casual as men when it comes to dating and sex. And I think it's just a little bit more socially acceptable in the last couple of years than it ever has been.
Yeah, it's going to continue to get, it's continuing to be more and more socially acceptable, but it will never be the same. And it shouldn't, because women by nature must be more defended in their sexuality. There's very important deep biological reasons why that needs to be true, and that will always be true.
What are some of those
reasons? All right.
Very, very good. Very good. You know, we will actually, we will continue the show next week, and we're actually going to have if you'd like to call back next week, we will have a discussion. We have a couple of listeners that might be calling in. So feel free to call back next week and we will be live and we'll have as much time as we need to talk about more questions. Caller, I didn't get your name. Can you tell us your name, please?
My name is Jackie.
Jackie, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you guys very much for the conversation.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.